Hey, what's up? I'm Gautam Sharma, and you're listening to the Access Cyber Podcast. On the show today, my guest, Jack Reesider. Jack is the host of the Darknet Diaries podcast. He is an InfoSec practitioner and a master storyteller. You're going to enjoy this episode. Here we go. Jack Reesider, welcome to the show. Very excited to have you on with us today.
Wow, thanks so much for being here. I'm excited to be here too.
I've been listening to your show since the first episode, hanging on to every episode, waiting for the next episode release. And I'm very excited to know that I'm not the only one. Everyone I speak to in the community is such a huge fan of Darknet Diaries. There's no one who hasn't heard of it. Even people outside of our industry are excited about the show because it's so digestible. You don't have to be a security expert to enjoy the show or understand it. How did you build something like this? Where does that knack for storytelling come from?
It's kind of a surprise that it's gotten so big. I mean, originally this was just something I wanted to hear, and I was like, "Where is that podcast?" And I frantically searched, and I couldn't quite find one that I thought was exactly what was in my head, and so I just made it, and here it is. So if we go back, I mean, I have a long, rich passion for computers, and so I've actually been a network security engineer for 10 years, and so I had that, right? And I was just, you know, I'd go to conferences, and I'd meet people with crazy stories, and sometimes I just want to hear those stories over and over, right? Like, this is the time I accidentally pen tested a company, but it was the wrong company and I broke in, and that it was a big problem. I was like, whoa, tell me all about that, right? So these are funny stories or crazy stories or high drama. I mean, there's always something wild about them. And yeah, I was like, well, I love podcasts, so I'll just bring that to a podcast. And I mean, I had blogged for like 7 years before making a podcast. And so I was explaining really complex technical topics as simply as I could. So I think there is a lot of practice that I did there. And I gave a lot of presentations at work, which is just like a PowerPoint presentation of here's what you need to do in order to get this thing done, or here's why we need to change policy or something, you know? So I think that's kind of what led into it. But then when it was time for me to say, okay, let's make this show, I had to learn. I wanted to learn all the skills in storytelling. And so there's a Khan Academy course on that Pixar creates on storytelling. Like, they teach, you know, character development and story arc and all this stuff by Pixar. So that was cool. I picked up some stuff there. And then some of the other podcasters that I really like This American Life and 99% Visible and Radiolab have created a book called Out on the Wire. And they explain kind of the formula of how they pick their stories and make their stories and a whole process there. And I think that book was really influential to me to kind of make it very similar to what they were doing.
You're drawing from so many sources that are outside of security, which is what's interesting to me.
When I first started too, I was like, well, you know, my dentist is talking to me about hacks and my barber is talking to me about hacking. Like, everyone seems to be talking about this. So I wanted to make it accessible to them too. You know, so I kind of had like a multi-prong approach to how can I make like a good story, but then also be well researched. And then, you know, I kind of like the whole story too. So it's kind of like a slow news story, because I'll wait like 6 or 10 years for us to know all the pieces of the puzzle before doing that story. And I think that's when we can finally do that story justice. If you tell me, oh, breaking news, this place got breached. Okay, great. But I don't know by who or all the things they stole or what the impact is, right? We're going to tune back in next month to figure that stuff out. And then, you know, once the hacker gets caught, we got to tune back in 2-3 years from now to figure out who did it. And then when the hacker gets sentenced and all the, you know, the fallout from the whole thing, we had the LinkedIn breach was like 2013. Well, people used that information to hack into Donald Trump's Twitter account 3 years later, right? So like all the fallout of things that have happened after a breach is really what I like to kind of step way back from and look at, and then wrap all that up into one story that we can tell from the very beginning all the way to the very end, because it's finally over. And that's really kind of what I think people resonate with, is to be able to tell that whole story and not just the breaking news stuff or the super technical stuff, but like that, just that whole thing.
it's almost the, when we think about reporting, it's almost the opposite, right? Let's get the quickest thing out the earliest. And that's how reporters are rewarded. It's the breaking news. It's the, we're the first ones to report it, or we have, you know, even if we don't have the full story, we're going to go out there because we want to be the first to report. This long sort of approach, this long form approach is a little bit different. How do we know when a story ends? How do we know we have all the details?
So one of the things I have is a Google alert, which tells me, it emails me whenever there's a story out there that gets published that says hacker sentenced. If that shows up in any story and on the whole internet, Google will find it and they, you know, and they'll email me and say, hey, there's this story out there that says that in there. And so when I see that hacker sentenced, well, now I can go backwards and say, what was the verdict? You know, guilty or not guilty? Obviously guilty, right? So then we can go back and say, how did this hacker get caught? And then, you know, we might have court documents that say this is how they got caught or whatever, or news stories, because, you know, possibly people were covering it in the news. And then I can go back even further and say, well, how did they hack whatever it is they hacked? And so that's kind of like my favorite thing, is to wait for the hacker to be sentenced. And then I can kind of say, all right, this story's done. What more could, you know, come out of this now that we've got them caught and all this stuff is done here. So that to me kind of feels like the end. But yeah, I mean, if we've done a lot of threat intelligence research and kind of, you know, have a good firm finger on who's done this as well, even if we haven't caught them, like sometimes, you know, nation state hackers do something that is they never got any caught or anything for that, because you don't, how do you catch a nation state hacker? It just doesn't work. So you know, in that case, we just have a strong finger saying, here's all the evidence that points to this country that did this, then that's another way that we can kind of wrap things up. And that sometimes takes years too.
Right, for sure. So it sounds like patience is definitely part of the name of the game. It's a very creative use of Google Alerts. I'm gonna make a note of that for my own purposes,
yeah, so,
as well.
Some other Google alerts I have are, well, hacker killed, because if there's ever a hacker that gets killed, that's interesting, or killed from hack. You know, there was a recent hospital that got ransomware attack, and that was blowing up in my Google alerts of a person died because of a ransomware attack on a hospital. Hacker arrested. That's another one. Or hack that reads like a movie plot. That's one Google alert I have. Or biggest hack ever is another Google alert I have. So I just have a whole bunch of these little things to help me find stories. So, I mean, a lot of times it doesn't work out because there's somebody with the last name hacker.
Right.
That doesn't quite fit. And there's a lot of video game hacking that people claim is hacking when it's really, I don't know, glitching or something.
Are there other tools beyond Google Alerts? Like, what does your toolkit look like?
Well, at first, I mean, to find stories, I think is what you're asking about. And at first, I was, you know, just aware of the stories that were out there because I'd been in this field for so long. So I knew the big ones. And then I would go to conferences and I would hear people tell stories on stage. And so I'm like, well, you already told it on stage at this conference. Can you just come on my show and tell me the same story? And so that's how I was kind of getting some early stories, was rehashing some of my favorite talks that were kind of storytelling talks and not quite, you know, technical talks. And then I listen to a lot of podcasts as well and say, oh, wow, that person has quite a story. Like, you know, honestly, John McAfee talking about how he went on the run and all this stuff was such a gripping story to me when I first heard him tell that on a podcast like 6 years ago. Just the wild adventures he was on. I couldn't stop listening to that show. I was so engrossed. And so I was like, that's what I want to hear more of, is hackers telling me the story about how they're on the run and they're running from this and that and all these things. So, I mean, it's just keep my ears open and see what's out there and pick them up as I find them. And now the show's gotten so big that people are bringing me stories, or people are getting out of prison and then reaching out and saying, I don't know who you are, but everyone says I need to contact you. And I'm like, okay, right. That sounds like a good start.
Sure. There's a lot of debate on what the word hacker means. What's your definition?
I think a hacker is just somebody who makes something do something that doesn't want to be done. So, you know, even if my car doesn't start in the morning, well, it should be starting, but it's not starting, right? So I've got to kind of hack it to get it started, right? So it doesn't want to start, but a hacker would get it to start. You're just getting over, a barrier of some kind. You're hacking something. That's kind of my loose definition, which makes us all hackers, because we've all faced like a problem, like, ah, this isn't working. I've got to figure out a way to fix it. Yeah, well, I think you're a hacker in that case. However, I use the term hacker on the show quite a lot to just be a person who used a computer to do something malicious.
Yeah, so there's different contexts for the term, I think. You brought up the car, and I'm reminded of just preliminary research I was doing. Just you tweeted a conversation you had with an automotive magazine.
Oh, yeah. You want me to say what that was?
Yeah.
So I was talking to an automotive magazine. I was getting interviewed there, but I said that IT security is like, picture it like it's the brakes of a car. And because a lot of people don't like IT security, they're like, oh, it slows me down. They're always saying no and all these things, which is what kind of a brakes of a car is. But I think the brakes of a car is more like that. It gives you the ability to drive fast. None of us would be driving fast if we didn't have brakes, because we need that ability to slow down and be safe. And without that, we wouldn't drive fast at all. So, yeah, I think security enables us to go fast because it gives us that safety buffer that we need in order. Like, I think that the internet is a very hostile environment. And in order to do business in a hostile environment, you need a good layer of security in order to do that. I mean, 15 years ago, if you would have told me, let's put our credit cards on the internet and buy stuff, I would have been like, no way, I'm not doing that. But now we've learned how to do business in this hostile environment because of security. So they're the brakes that let us go faster, if that makes any sense.
I want to talk about this point now, about the cards and the internet. What sort of precautions are you taking from a security standpoint?
Well, I mean, I try to do best practices because I like to exercise them, right? So, you know, I make websites and stuff for the podcast and all this, and I want to make sure those are secure, because if somebody is like pointing all these problems out on my own world, things I do, then how could I be the one talking about how to secure stuff? So I got to make sure to exercise all the best practices, just because I think it's good practice and it's good as, you know, my brand, I suppose. But I'm familiar with the whole scene of how to stay secure and keep things secure and just do all the things. So, you know, I'm using password managers and VPNs and antivirus tools and updating my applications and not clicking on things or downloading things or opening links and stuff that I'm not expecting or don't recognize or, you know, can't sanitize or something in a way. But so, I'm very cautious with all the things that come my way and do the best I can. I also, you know, like you said, practice good OPSEC. I don't like to show pictures of myself or where I'm at in the world or anything that can be personal. I don't think that it really is necessary to be putting online. I'm a big privacy advocate. So even if I wasn't like a public person, I just don't see the point of, I mean, I just kind of cringe every time somebody has their kids in photos and stuff and all these things. I'm just like, it's just not, let's not go. Like, you don't want to do that. Those kids didn't opt for that and I don't like it. So yeah, that's always bugged me.
And I think it's important to take those precautions, right? There's just so many different ways of that those things cause harm and things like that.
Well, I mean, I think I'll just rapid fire like four things that come to mind, you know, and I said that just a second ago. Keep things up to date, use a password manager on all different websites, use an antivirus. And then I also think it's really good to protect your email. This is becoming more and more important. We used to think like protecting your social security number here in the States was important. I think now protecting your email is probably more important. Like if someone else gets access to your email, they can then issue password resets for any other application that you have connection to. So your bank or PayPal or anything that you can imagine, it probably has, you know, your email tied to it. So if you have anyone who can access it, like a spouse or a significant other or something, like if they leave you, you want to change that password. You probably don't want to share that password at all with them. You know, like protecting it as well, like making sure that when you're typing it in, it's actually the website that you're typing it into, because a lot of times you'll get a phishing email that says, oh, you have this thing. And then when you go to click it, it's like, oh, well, we need you to log in first. Okay, fine. And so you're logging in to the email website that you're actually on. Like, it doesn't make sense, right? So you have to, you know, just be very careful, protect your email, and don't give it out willy-nilly too, because I think you know, once it's easy for people to get access to it, or, you know, and there's two parts to it, right? There's the email address and the password. If you know the email address, that's half of it already. So if you don't know someone's email, then that's harder already. And so you might have like a burner, well, not a burner, but like a more of a spammy, dirty email address that you use to just like write a bunch of letters or things or sign up for junk. I don't know. But then you have like a more secure one that's like connected to your banks or something. That might be a good idea.
Yeah, that's good. Just sort of segmenting different parts of your life. How do we convey this, the urgency and the sense of importance that privacy has to like younger generations? Let's start there. Or people who just think, what does it matter if Alexa's in my kitchen? I'm not having any top secret conversations here, or everything is already out there already. What is the message for those folks?
Yeah, it's hard to sell them, because what we're living in is like a feature-rich opportunity when we have things like that. And the features seem to outbalance the security. I think in the 80s and 90s, we kind of did quite a lot of damage, or probably even before that, but just quite a lot of damage to the environment, right? And it's going to take us decades to put that genie back in the bottle and fix the environment damage that we've done. And I think the same thing is kind of happening to our privacy. The last 20 years or so, we've just been letting privacy get loose in a million different ways. And at some point, there is going to be a tipping point where we say, uh-oh, this was a big problem. We shouldn't have given all these companies our private data. We need to pull this back. And I think the younger generation is going to have to figure that out someday and say, okay, I think it was bad for us to install TikTok and all these things. We didn't realize at the time. I think another thing is just education. Like, you know, this is explaining to people who, you know, like these features and stuff, like, hey, this is what these companies have on you. And you can go, like, I think Spotify at least lets you do it, and you can request all the information Spotify has on you, and you can look and you can see, and they'll send you this. And it's quite freaky and scary to see that they can see, you know, all the different locations of when you were playing music, where you were in the world, what songs you played, for how long you played each one, what ads you saw during that time. Like, they track every single thing they could possibly track about you. And if you have the apps installed on your phone, then they can see all the other phones that were installed and all these things. And of course, I mean, they just want to gather this much information on you to build a better experience for you, and to you know, possibly sell that to advertisers, right? Because they have these advertising funnels, and advertisers are like, well, do you know any, like, well, ask Spotify, do you know anyone who is interested in buying this kind of car? And then the Spotify's like, yeah, we actually have these people who have you know, done have these kind of you know, profiles that would be interested. And so, you know, there's all kinds of like weird communication that go on about you. I mean, what I like is that there's shows like The Social Dilemma. Have you seen this documentary that came out?
I did, on Netflix.
Yeah, yes. Shows like that, I think, do teach a lot of people things. So I think more stuff like that is helpful as well.
Is there something out there right now that's actually, it doesn't have to be a specific tool or product or company, but is there something out there that is helping people value their privacy more?
Like Signal and Wire and stuff are helping with these kind of situations. But then there's people who just install Kik, and Kik doesn't have like any sort of security at all, and is really horrible, actually. And so, yeah, like, I guess some things are getting better in some ways, but then some things are getting worse on the other side.
Sure. I want to talk more about, you're still actively working in the security field in addition to this, is that correct?
No, I quit my job about 4 or 5 months into the podcast. So at work, they were having me build a SOC, and they gave me such a high, I don't know, the project was impossible to be successful at. It literally was. Like, for instance, they were saying, here are three technicians, and we want a 24/7 SOC, 365. And I was like, well, it's impossible to have three people working 24/7, 365. Like, this does, and they're like, you need to figure it out. I'm like, there's no way to figure it out. They've done the math. You can't do it. I need 10 at the minimum. And they're like, we can't have 10. So, like, these are the kind of things that were driving me insane at this job. So I was like, okay, I've been there 10 years. This is the project that I think is going to break me. And then this podcast started up, and it was getting some traction. So I was like, okay, let me just take a 3-month break from technical work, see if I can focus on this podcast, see if I can get past like the dip of it not really making any money because I wasn't putting ads in it or anything, and just get through that. And I was able to, at the end of 3 months, start seeing a very small trickle of income through the podcast, which was able to just kind of get me another month. I didn't know what was going to happen after that, but then I started seeing it gain speed. So yeah, I mean, that was kind of the transition there.
A few months into the podcast, we were able to quit your job. And so we don't have to dig deep into financial or anything, but are you at a point now where you've replaced that income?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. I'm making as much as I was as a security engineer. And I got to say that podcasting, being a professional, I don't know, a paid podcaster, somebody who's making a decent amount, is quite rare. It's like only 1% of podcasters can actually acquire that. And yeah, it's just very difficult to get there.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. It's become so easy to launch a podcast these days, number one. But I think the quality episodes and quality shows still rise to the top, which is just a testament to how Dark Knight Diaries got there. When we talk about financials, what are the different revenue streams you're employing to kind of grow this brand now?
So I have ads in episodes, and I have Patreon, and I have t-shirt sales. Those are my three main incomes.
Okay. I saw the t-shirts are fantastic, by the way. Do you do that art yourself?
No, I found that artists can either, and maybe I just haven't found a good artist yet, but they either can come up with the concept, or they can come up with, or they can actually execute on the idea. And some artists are really cool at coming up with concepts, but suck at actually making them come to life. And some are really good at, making them come to life, but just can't really come up with the idea. So I come up with the ideas, and then I'll dry them on the back of a napkin or mash them up like, you know, kind of a photo collage of ideas that I have in my head. I know enough about, Photoshop to get the idea out. And then I send it to a graphic designer, and then he illustrates them and sends them back.
Very cool. I just downloaded recently the 3D printer file for the Surveillance Raven.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful thing. I'm looking forward to having it on my desk. We'll put a link somewhere below for people to look at if they haven't seen it. But it's just, how would you describe that
thing? Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, is there some sort of collectible I could have for this show? And so I've made some 3D print files. One is like a USB trident. So the USB symbol has like kind of like a 3-prong tip to it. I like that symbol. Mm-hmm. So I made that into a trident. And then I have this Raven that has a CCTV camera as a head, and that was used for one of the episodes. And I gave it to someone on Fiverr and said, hey, can you turn this into a 3D model? And they did. And so there we go. We can print them out now. It's kind of fun.
The art is it's really fantastic. What I like about what you just explained about the two types of artists is I've never really thought about it this way, but the concept artist and the execution piece, that's interesting to me, right? So the ability to come up with the ideas in art itself.
I kind of feel like I had a lot of ideas in my head, and I'm just like, oh, one day I wish I could have this. Like I don't want a personal chef in my life. I want like a personal artist, and a personal coder, and a personal designer, and all these things so that I could just say, make this for me, and make that for me, and make that for me. And then whoop-de-doo, it comes back to me, right? So I'm finally getting to that point where I could just say, all right, I can just keep pumping out artwork that's been in my head and ideas that I get. And I mean, I'll be walking through the mall or something, and I'll see like a glimpse of something, and I'll be like, oh, that'd be really cool, but in this design instead of that. And, you know, I just have these concepts that come to me. So yeah, I'm just kind of waving my wand around over here and getting all sorts of cool stuff created from it.
So there's an artist in your team. What else have you kind of, what other tasks in the podcast are people working on? I mean, you're obviously the host of the show. You're doing research. What are the other roles on the team?
I mean, I made the artwork, which is not very good, but I did my best, right? And all the stuff and all the writing, producing, writing, narrating, sound design, everything, website building, the whole works.
Okay.
But by the time I got to episode 40, it was starting to like, you know, create an income that I could get some help. So now we're on episode 77, and I have 3 different producers that I work with, 2 different sound designers. I have a writer, so I'm looking for another writer. I have an editor I have another editor. So one editor takes out the ums and uhs of my recording, and another editor says, hey, you don't know how to talk English. You need to rephrase the way you just said that. And so they do that kind of thing, right? So there's different kinds of editors for different things. And I have like three different graphic designers that I use for different things. And that's a good chunk of it.
What are you spending in, like, how much time is being spent in a week on this, like, hours
wise? So to make an episode, if I were to do it by myself, takes about 60 hours. So I just imagine that's how much time it takes some of these other people to get things done, because they are just as professional as me. But for some reason, when we do start working in teams, it takes twice as long. And I'm not sure exactly what the issue is there. It's just because there's more people talking and there's more things you have to get out of your head to explain, and you got to be able to interface with other people. So your little chicken scratch notes aren't as good when you're dealing in a team. You've got to write coherently. I don't know. So it just takes twice as long. So that's the reason why I have a writer working on one episode, which is totally different than a producer working on another episode, which is totally, you know, a totally different episode than another producer working on another. So I have like four episodes in the pipe at once, or five or six, like everyone's working on different aspects of it. And then I'll kind of hand it from one person to another. And so I don't really know how long things take, because it's so multi-threaded at this point. And also some episodes have taken me a year to get somebody to finally agree to be on the show too, right? So I've been emailing them and calling them and asking them over and over, can I please get an interview with you? And, you know, it doesn't go very long. It takes a long time. So some stuff just takes forever to do that. And yeah, it's just a lot of different variants.
What does your day look like? Is there a routine? Are there certain, I want to get to know just you outside of Darknet Diaries real quick. What is your routine like? Look like? Are there certain, I don't know, let's call them life secrets you've discovered? I don't know, things that help you in your day-to-day life.
So this year has been a crazy year, hasn't it? For one sure. of the things that kind of hit me about this year was I kind of like tried to reinvent myself in a couple ways. So like I did a lot of workouts this year and tried to build some muscle mass, which was kind of something I haven't done all my life. So that was kind of a new thing. I was learning how to play guitar, which is something I really haven't done all my life either. Just I don't know how I got into that, but that just happened. And but the thing that's kind of really been doing stuff for me is meditation and reading books, or at least listening to audiobooks that take me outside my thought, my current worldview, right? So I think I've got the world figured out. But as I'm getting older, this is the thing, like, when I was in my teenage years, I was questioning everything. And I was like, why do you believe that? And why can't we do it this way? And all that kind of stuff. And then you kind of settle into like a belief system. And now when I'm much older, I'm like, this has just been a year that I'm like, let's revisit everything. Nothing makes sense to me anymore. The world just doesn't make sense. I need to make it right again. So let me just kind of tear down all my beliefs and rebuild them to what I think should be good again. So I don't know if it's just a midlife kind of thing or what's going on, but the thing is I've been doing a lot of meditation. And in this meditation, I'll give you an example. What the heck is consciousness? Like, I can close my eyes and imagine a dog. How? Where is that in the brain, right? There is no place in the brain that we can say that's where the conscious is. The conscious doesn't exist. There's just no thing. But yet I can picture this in my head, and I can picture sounds, and I can picture smells and all these things in the consciousness, yet it's not there. And so then you step back again and say, wait, if I can picture that, who's picturing that? And kind of turn that view around and say, who am I, how in my mind's eye am I looking at this wall of imagery in my brain with my eyes closed? Who's looking at this thing? Like, who am I? So I'm just kind of like turning that focus around to try to look at who I am, and that there's no one there. Like, there's nothing inside the head. Like, there's no one home. And that's really a wild concept that I've just been like really searching through my head for like the last 6 months, and totally like, what's going on here?
If you discover the answer, please let me know.
Yeah, that's crazy.
there's a lot of just Eastern philosophy around the self and identity and all these things that even modern psychology draws from. Is there like a style of meditation that you've discovered works for you? What is your meditation?
So there's a waking up app by Sam Harris, which is just really great. It's Sam has a lot of things that he says that just really go make you think in a weird way, like for the rest of the day, like how, what? And then so that's what I've been going after, is just this daily meditation through that app. But there's so much other stuff going on in that app that it's just so always fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, big fan of Sam Harris. A lot of his work has been really great. Okay, so meditating, working out, playing the guitar, amazing. What can you play on the guitar?
Just some old classic rock songs. I like Pink Floyd, Radiohead, Beatles.
Love it. What is a belief that has stood the test of time for you in your mind? Or is nothing fit that category? Are you just chucking everything?
All right. Yeah. Another book that kind of I read that was pretty wild was Harari. What was his name? He wrote a book called Homo Sapiens. There's this guy, Harari is the last name. He wrote a book, three books, right? So one is about history, one is about the current times, and one is about the future. And he's a historian. And just the way he writes kind of really fascinates me. So like for instance, he talks about a lot of myths that happen in the world that we don't really have a way to prove, right? So he calls religions a myth and stuff like that. But, you know, another thing he calls as a myth is a country. A country is just something in our heads. We just decided this is a country. There's no like reality to it. It's just that's what we decided. And same with money. Like we decided money is money. It would worth something, but that's a myth, right? So he's got this really fascinating way of calling all these things myths. And one thing that has stood the test of time, because that was your question, is my compassion for animals. In the latest book I was reading, I think it's Homo Deus. He just talks about how cruel we've been to animals throughout our entire life. And that's always been a thing for me. And I'm actually vegetarian. And so, you know, rebuilding all my myths, all my, you know, my truths and stuff from the ground up this year, boom, I was good on that one. Animal cruelty is still bad. And I still am happy to be a vegetarian. And I have not wavered on that in quite a long time.
How did that get instilled in you?
Oh, I don't know. It just seems like... It didn't seem like a very nice thing when I was younger, right? Like, that's not a good idea, and that's some gross stuff. A corpse? What? Sure. I don't want to eat a corpse. So it just didn't make sense to me as a young one. And then, you know, it's kind of stuck with me, and now I'm you know, seeing, yep, that was a good call.
No, it's true. I think there's value in that that childlike mind, right? There's a lot of things that children get right that we teach out of them, and we in an effort to mature them or make them and turn them into adults and things like that. This animal, the corpse thing is totally on point. I've been reading a lot about like simulation theory and things like that. Have you?
Yeah. So that was when I was listening to Lex Friedman's podcast AI. He had someone on there that started talking about that, and yeah, that was another thing that I'm like, wait, what? How could this whole world just exist in my head? That's it. Like, there's nothing beyond this. Right. And so, yeah, I got to get in more into that, because he kind of just talks briefly about it. But some of the stuff I heard was like, okay, yeah, So that's another thing that I need to dive deep into, because this is the year for that. You know, like, let's see how much truth there is to this simulation theory.
I mean, if it's someone's idea of a game, I mean, this feels like a pretty high level of it. Jack, this was a lot of fun. I am really excited we got to do this, and I'm looking forward to hopefully making more time on my end and your end to do more of these conversations and just talking about consciousness. I think we could do 2 hours on consciousness.
Yeah, easy.
where can people find you in the rare event they haven't heard of?
You know, this reminds me, I need to make an AOL keyword, because I think if I make an AOL keyword, then I'll have every search engine ever available. So any search engine you can think of, or place that you can search for anything, type in Dark Knight Diaries and you'll find me. You wanted to get into brands a little bit. Like, that was something you said at the beginning before we started. And Yeah. There was this guy, Gary Vaynerchuk, who said, you want to be known out there. You got to get on all the social medias because people are driving down the road, watching their phones, reading social media. And so that's the place to be. And so that made me think, okay, I better get on all the social medias. So yeah, I am available on Instagram, LinkedIn. I even have a Pinterest board where I sometimes just post things there, like here's artwork and stuff. So Facebook. And so I hate all these social media places, but it is such a great place to market your, if you have something to market, and I do, that's what I do, is I go on all these social media places and do it. And sure enough, it's worked. I think word of mouth is still one of the best ways to market. And it's worked for me on social media.
I was about to wrap this up, but you just sparked a new question in my mind. Is there a dissonance between being such a security and privacy focused individual and then having to embrace social for the
growth? Oh my gosh. So I have like a special VM just to get on Facebook. I don't want Facebook to know because they put all these tracking pixels and then they add all the stuff. Yeah, they just build a profile on it. So I don't like it. And I kind of touch it with like a 2 foot long stick. Yeah, I think Facebook is the thing I'm least on. I haven't answered any private messages on Facebook in almost a year now. I post only, but I don't really go on there and interact. So I just do that kind of thing. Instagram's another thing. I have a special device just with Instagram on it and stuff like that. So I just try to segregate these kind of things, and it's hard. It's hard because I'm trying to scoop up listeners and at the same time I'm there. And so am I being two-faced or something, like, is this acceptable or not? Like, I should draw a line in the sand or something.
You mentioned this VM thing, virtual machine you're running.
I've got a whole rack of computers. Server rack, and I've got VMs that I can spin up. And then, but there's like it's like a 2U server in the rack. And so it's like a pretty beefy thing. It's got like 100 gigs of RAM in it and stuff. So, I could just spin up VMs all day long there and do stuff. I RDP into that, and then away I go. And I love using Tails for lots of things, which is a virtual machine that you can then, it automatically connects you to Tor. And as soon as you shut down Tails, it deletes everything because it only exists in RAM. So RAM gets purged as soon as you shut down. So it's a nice way to get dirty on the internet and then clean yourself, right? So, and I've got a couple of Raspberry Pis that I get into and, use Linux kinds from. And I've got a couple of, Linux servers in the cloud that I can jump around on and do stuff. So I love having access to all these different types of things. I have a few things. I have a bot that I have running on Twitter. I had a couple bots running on Twitter. So, when I was first trying to build my following, I would follow a lot of people who I thought were following interesting people, right? So, like anybody I like, if somebody followed them, I would follow them. So it's kind of weird. But then I have another bot that for a different Twitter account, I've got a few different Twitter accounts and they just do things. So they retweet stuff about podcasting and things. And then I have another Raspberry Pi that puts together some, it downloads some YouTube videos and then puts them together in a way I need. And then I have another Raspberry Pi that does a Pi hole to stop ads. That thing is amazing.
Thanks for walking me through that. That's useful. And then let's end with this. What's the what's next for Darknet Diaries?
I'm going to build a book one day, so I just need to get the time to do it. Hopefully, if I can get some more people helping with the show, then I'll have time to do stuff like that. And a second podcast has been in the works for quite a while, so I'd like to do that. And it's kind of like a long-form one, so some of these episodes I do are 1 hour, but some of the topics really require more than that, like election hacking, right? That's a many-hour-long topic. Probably boring to many people because it's just we've heard about it so much, but, I mean, we're talking about Russia in 1 hour, we're talking about Cambridge Analytica for another hour. We're talking about how vulnerable these machines are for another hour. Then, you've got gerrymandering, which is another, the whole political part, like there's actually hacking going on there, not so much in the technical space, but in the let's get people to vote in this particular way to do something. And then, you know, I don't know. So I think that that's a bigger case, a bigger story, which may create a bigger podcast. Not bigger, but longer.
Cool. So it sounds like a lot of interesting new things coming down the pipeline. Jack, this was so much fun. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks again for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this, there's a ton more content available over at accesscyber.org. That's accesscyber.org. Accesscyber.org. Thanks for tuning in, and as always, happy hacking.